So hi everyone, thanks for coming. So today I'll talk about spin ices, which are very interesting materials which have very unusual and surprising properties that arise or emerge because of their frustrated interaction. So during this talk, I'll try to make sense of this title, give you an introduction to this subject. And I apologize for people who went to my seminar because it will be essentially the same thing, but like version 2.0. All right, so the bulk of this talk would be just an introduction to spin ice. Then if I have time, I have some slides on a bit of recent research I've done last summer to give you an idea of what kind of exciting things are going on now in the field. And then I have some conclusions and ideas for future work I will be involved in during my PsyEssay. All right, so spin ice. Okay, so first you have to understand what frustration is, right? And so frustration refers to systems which have competing interaction, and by that I mean that cannot be satisfied simultaneously. So in a magnetic systems perspective, the simplest thing you can do is imagine doing a simple Ising model on a triangular lattice, which interact antiferromagnetically, right? So suppose you try to construct a ground state for this theory, then you put a spin down here, a spin up here, and then what shall you put there, right? There's no good answer. It could be either up or down, and one of these interactions will not be satisfied, right? So the geometry frustrates the system in that there is no way you can satisfy or minimize simultaneously all interactions. In 3D, you might think of doing some kind of lattice like this, which is made of plenty of triangles, like there are corners sharing tetrahedra. This is called the pyrochlore lattice. And if you imagine doing an Ising, a kind of Ising-like system on this lattice, then you essentially end up with spin ice. The idea is that real materials can be captured by exactly these kinds of models. And these are spin ices. So they are, to summarize, magnetic insulators. So they have localized magnetic moments that sit on the sides of this highly frustrated lattice, which is made of plenty of triangles, right? And they have a preferred quantization axis along the axis that go through the tetrahedra summits like this, right? And the net effect of interactions in these materials between spin can be captured by an effectively ferromagnetic model, and that favors that two spins should be pointing in and two spins, so two spins should be pointing in and two spins should be pointing out of each of these tetrahedra. And the name spin ice comes from an analogy with the proton organization problem in usual water ice, which is depicted here. So here are the oxygens of ice, and the proton organize themselves such that two are close any given oxygen and two are far away. So the displacement vectors of these protons from the midpoint maps exactly to the spins and the spin ice problem. So that's where the name comes from. And those are the two most famous known materials which exhibit this kind of phenomenology. All right, the nice thing now is that if you try to count how many different ground states you can make with respect to this local condition of two spins in and two spins out, then this is an exponential number in the system size. So that leads to a ground state entropy, which grows linearly with the number of spins in the ground state. So that's a very surprising thing. Seems to be in contradiction with the third law of thermodynamics, right, which says that entropy should go to zero in the ground state. But the loophole is that in order for the third law to hold as we learn it, then you must have non-degenerate ground states, which is not the case here. You have an exponential degeneracy in the ground state. And so this has been realized by Pauling as early as in the 35. And a couple of years later, Gyorka et al. Measured the residual entropy at low temperature of spin ice, and it actually matches this. Okay, so water ice is an example of systems which has this phenomenology. OK, so now you might think, how do I construct a model which captures the physics of spin ice? So the first thing you can do is just a classical model in which you throw away every quantum mechanical aspect of it. So there's no quantum fluctuation. It's just an Ising model which has plus one or minus one on these spins. And you can fluctuate between these different equivalent ground states via thermal energy. And if you have very small temperature, then the thermal energy is much smaller than the average energy barrier between these different ground states. So we have very, very slow dynamics, but the model does not order, right? And it does not break any symmetry. So you might want to contrast this with the usual Ising type model on a square lattice, for example, in which below some temperature, the model spontaneously orders and break the symmetry. So this never happens in this these kinds of things. So the exotic features of these models, to summarize, so there's no long-range order at no temperature. So the model is fluctuating and does not order down to the lowest possible temperature, but it retains very strong correlations between spins. So it's not just like some disordered thing. It has very strong correlations between spins, so it decays as 1 over r cubed. So it's algebraic correlation, not exponentially decaying. And most famously, the excitations out of this ground state. So imagine flipping a spin from 2 in, 2 out, and you get 1 in, 3 out, or 3 in, 1 out. Take the form of deconfined magnetic monopoles. This was shown in 2007 in this famous article by Castelnuovo, Meusner, and Sundy. The idea is that you can think of this spin, which is a dipole moment, as two magnetic charges of different signs, which live at the end of a rod. Right? You can do the same thing with like electric dipoles, which is made of two separated charges, plus and minus. And when you flip a spin, you introduce a defect. So on this side, there is now one more, say, negative magnetic charge here, and one extra positive magnetic charge here. And because you have such a huge number of available ground states, then you can move this defect around in the lattice. So you need some finite energy cost to create them, let's say here and here. And then with no additional energy cost, you can move them around because all ground states are equivalent in energy. So you can create this pair of magnetic monopoles and then send them away to infinity with a finite energy cost. So that's how they're deconfined magnetic monopoles. And there have been experiments on this which tend to confirm this scenario. So this is an example. So the spin-spin correlation, so this two-point correlation function between the spins in Fourier space are almost directly probed by neutron scattering experiments. We can directly relate this physics to experiments and compare them. So this is a famous experiment that was done in 2009. This is the actual experimental plots, and this is the theoretical prediction. Right. So the classical models of spin ice have been quite successfully compared to experiments right now. And this is exciting. All right. Now you can now allow for quantum mechanics to enter this problem. And you can ask the question, what does the t equals zero phase would look like if you allow quantum tunneling direct between these ground states? So not thermal energy anymore, but quantum tunneling. And the idea is that you could imagine forming a unique ground state by a coherent superposition of this exponential number of the generated ground state. And this would be a phase that would fluctuate, so would not be ordered even at strictly t equals zero, while still retaining very strong correlations between spins. So that's what we call a quantum spin liquid. On the experimental side, this is much more, this is much less solid. However, this fall, there has been the first experiment which claimed to have found a quantum spin liquid in real materials. So this is becoming quite hot right now. All right, in the quantum side, then you still have these magnetic monopoles as excitations, but you have two new things that appear because you allow this quantum tunneling process. And I try to make clear in the following slides how this happened exactly. So you get two new things, another gapped excitation, so with a finite energy cost, we created them, which are weird stuff that I'll talk a bit more later. They're called Weisen. And in some sense, there are some emergent electric charges, as much as these magnetic monopoles can be seen as emergent magnetic charges. I'll try to show you how this happened. And you also have photon-like excitations that are gapless, so that whose energy goes to zero as k go to zero. I tried to show you a minimal model which shows exactly this kind of behavior. Of course, now this becomes a pretty much hand-wavy, because this mapping is quite involved and subtle. I cannot do every detail here, but just try to give you an idea of how this works. So this is the minimal Hamiltonian. This is an Ising-like term, which couples the z component of the spins with some j coupling. And here you have a small perturbation, which induces quantum fluctuations. So it is like the s plus and minus operators. And you assume that this guy is much smaller than the Ising term. Right? And now you can do perturbation theory in g perp over gzz. And you can turn the crank. And what you find is that to lowest order, the effective Hamiltonian is some constant time this operator, which is this guy. So it's a six-spin operator. And it's defined in an hexagon. So I can show you a picture. This is the easiest way to understand it. So purple sites are sites on the pyrochlore lattice in which the spins live. And the idea is, if you're doing a low-energy perturbation theory, then you essentially want to map a ground state to another ground state. Right? You throw away the gapped excitation. And if you just try to flip one spin, then it introduces a defect, a magnetic monopole. Then you might want to split the following spin. Then it just moves as the magnetic monopole. Right? So if you want to get rid of this monopole, then you have to make a closed loop in the lattice. So you flip a spin, you create a defect here, you propagate it all the way around until it comes back to its initial position. And now you're in an allowed ground state again. So the idea is to find the closest loop of spins in this lattice you can all turn around to generate excitations. And that's an hexagon if you look at the geometry. So this is the red loop like this you can flip around. Okay. Now this model with these loop excitations that I've shown you can be mapped into an emergent electromagnetism problem. So we're essentially building a theory on a lattice which has exactly the same algebraic structure, and so that mimics electromagnetism. And its excitations then would also have the same properties. How it works is you map the spins that live on a pyrochlore lattice to a field, that let's call it a magnetic field, defined on another lattice. I also have a picture to show you how this works. So the red arrows are the spins that live on the pyrochlore lattice sites. Then you just build a lattice starting from the center of these tetrahedra to all other centers. And then you see that these spins sort of live on this lattice bonds now, or on this links. So you map these spins here to a field that live on these bonds. And now remember that we had one constraint, which was that on each given tetrahedra, then you should have two spins pointing in and two spins pointing out. So in terms of this field now, and you can see where it goes. Right? So it's exactly mapped on a divergence-free condition for the field. If you look at any given tetrahedra, there's two of these fluxes going in and two of these fluxes going out. So there should be no flux going out of, no total flux or net flux going out. Yeah.
How do we get from the red arrows to the blue arrows? Is that simple?
What are the blue arrows?
Are the blue arrows just the sum of the red arrows or something like
this? I don't even remember what the blue arrows are. I look at this. I have the references. I don't think they're pretty important. Yeah, I look at them. But I mean, mathematically, there's a way that you should do this. And it's more subtle than just saying you do this and that. I can show you the references. But the idea is that now your B field that you define like this is divergence-less. Right? So it has no net flux. And so you can write it like a lattice curl of some other vector field. Right? You have a gauge redundancy here. So you end up with a gauge theory for the gauge field A, but everything is defined on lattice bonds now. Right? And so you should worry about how you should generalize the concept of divergence and curl to this lattice. So the divergence is easy. It's just summing whatever comes out of one given site. And the curl can be taken along these hexagons that I just showed you. And you end up with a field which lives on an outer lattice which goes through this hexagon. It's geometrically non-trivial, but this is the idea. And now, if you allow quantum tunneling between different ground states, then this gauge field A becomes explicitly time-dependent. And what happens if you have A, which is time-dependent, then you generate some other field, which goes roughly like this. And you can show that these fields respect the usual commutation relations for electromagnetism. Right? I know there might be a minus wrong there, but see what I mean. And if you do this mapping properly, then this effective Hamiltonian, which was there in terms of spin operators, this guy, then upon mapping and writing in this new language, in terms of these fields on the lattice, then you have this Hamiltonian, right? This is exactly the electromagnetic, the Hamiltonian for electromagnetism. The only two differences are it's on the lattice, so you should sum the contribution for each of the bonds instead of each of the space-time points. And these constants are renormalized constants. So. So quantum spin ice in this low energy limit, it's equivalent to a lattice U1 gauge theory, which exactly mimics electromagnetism. And of course, then it has the same structure. So you can still quantize A and it has this U1 gauge theory, so you end up with two physical transverse polarization modes that disperse linearly, and so these are the emergent photons. And these emergent photons, of course, they are not like real photons, so they have a different value of the speed of light, which is given by the like ratio of these two constants, which is much less in real materials than the actual speed of light. But otherwise, it's algebraically the same. No, they cannot be. I glossed over this thing, I guess. So they cannot be defined on the same lattice. Because when you take the curl, so these are dual in the sense that if you take the curl on the red lattice in which the B field lives, then you get something in the blue lattice in which A and the electric field E live. And if you take the curl on A and E lattice, then you end up on the B lattice. So when it's consistent with Maxwell equation, if you take curl of B, then you get derivative of E. And if you get curl of E, you get, so you can map from one lattice to another.
So these two letters that you, and how do you relate to the previous letters? So that's some mathematical subtlety.
Yeah, so the lattice on which the actual spins live in this is this one. Uh-huh. And then by taking these lattice curls, you can generate bonds which go like this or like this. And then you can generate the other one. Re gives you the original one, yeah.
Is the first lattice who lives on the first lattice?
The actual spins and the magnetic field. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Those are two diamond lattices.
I think it's like an actual electromagnetism. If you want to write down discrete Maxwell equations, you can do this with chains and cochains. So there you have the same thing, that the B field lives on the cochain and the electric field lives on a chain, and these are mathematical structures you can define.
That's interesting.
So it's like, I'm just saying that it's like in the actual electromagnetic field as well, so it's nothing fake here.
And then if you can also do the opposite thing, so you have a lattice theory, then you can coarse grain this thing and look at the continuum limit, and then you get exactly like traditional electromagnetism in the continuum. Is that clear?
Sorry. Does the blue diamond lattice also corresponding to another weird configuration?
I'm not sure I get this. Okay. I mean, they're just defined in this lattice, and B lives on one, E lives on the other. And if you take the curl of one, you get the other, and vice versa.
So you have two sets of lattice, and...
You have two lattices. There is only one a spin system on this lattice.
Okay.
The only one is a mathematical construction. Yeah, I guess we can talk about this
in
more
detail. Are you independent?
What?
You and K?
Yes. I think they're independent. They come from this mapping, so there's like a lot of things coming together to make these. And they are renormalized by. It travels at a renormalized speed of light, which is taken in the exact same way as these things. But I think the important thing is that it's exactly a U1 gauge theory with the same quadratic Hamiltonian as the electromagnetism, and it has the same algebraic commutation relation. So everything is the same, apart from the particular like numerical values of the constant. All right. There exist some definite predictions for if this phase actually exists, how it would look like in experiments. So this is the classical model. This is the corresponding quantum model, which has different features that could be experimentally observed. Next years will tell us if this phase is actually realized in materials or not. But we have definite predictions for what this would look like if it's the case. I don't really have time for this, I guess. I just wanted to give a hint of what kind of research I've worked on this summer in Dresden. It's about coupling spin-ice models to an electric field, and plenty of nice things appear when you do this. Just skip this part because I don't really have time, and skip to the conclusions. So I hope I've convinced you that spin-ices are very interesting material. So frustrated magnets, which host very unusual phases of matter, which exhibits dipolar correlations. It has no long-range order, no broken symmetries, and excitations in the form of deconfined magnetic monopoles. So this is a statement which is true for both the classical and quantum models. If you look at the quantum model, then there's this extra thing that this low energy limit of this model maps to a U1 gauge theory on a lattice, which is emergent electromagnetism. And it has emergent photon excitation. And what we've shown this summer is that when this is coupled to an external electric field, then the emergent photons couple to this electric field in some way that their properties change. And you can partially break the symmetry of the system to give rise to a new type, a new phase of quantum symmetry. Fortunately, I haven't have time to show you exactly how this works. And just some words about future work I expect to do at PI. So this idea we had is, people have wondered about these lattice emergent electromagnetism theories, always in the like infinite lattice case, which has exact translational symmetry and stuff like that. And it's interesting to wonder what happens if you try to confine these models, either classical or quantum, in one spatial dimension. Suppose you have a free surface or you have an interface with some other material, then what happens then? The interesting thing is that preliminary works, most of which is unpublished, so I cannot really talk about now, show that very interesting things could happen. The idea is that spin ice has very special correlations between spin that could induce new unknown states of matter at the surface or at the interface with different materials. We're trying to explore a bit in this direction for either classical or quantum models. So that's what I expect to work on for my PsyS. So that's everything. Thank you. You have questions?
How would you spot an emergent photon? Like, on which lattice does it live? Which observations could you see?
On which lattice does it live is not really a... So the problem is it propagates, right? And it's made of these electric and magnetic fields, which live on two different lattices. So it's sort of messy to see how exactly it propagates. However, you could see them in experiments with very definite predictions. So the point is that spin-spin correlations in Fourier space, so this two-point correlation function, can be exactly translated to prediction for neutron scattering experiments. So neutrons are neutral particles, but they have a magnetic moment, so they couple to these spins. And so by just sending neutrons and see what you get back, you can actually probe what are the spin-spin correlations of your system in Fourier space. And the fact that these photons are there are mapped to very specific kind of spin-spin correlations. So you could resolve them this way. And this is the kind of neutron scattering pattern you would get. This is the colors represent like the intensity of scattering for different wave vectors and stuff. So if the photons are there and this phase is realized, then you would see these kind of things in 2D. Or if you make a cut along the specific direction, then you see these kinds of intensity patterns. So you see that you have excitations that are linearly dispersing in K space. They go to zero linearly as K goes to zero. And you can also predict some stuff about the intensity you should see. So you cannot probe them directly, but they have a very like specific feature on spin-spin correlation.
So what if
is it
you
clear?
Don't have the photons, what would you see?
Well, you won't see this, right? So
you wouldn't see it.
So the question is, is this phase of matter, the U1 quantum spin liquid, realized or not in real materials? If it is, then this is what you should see, right? The photons come with this phase. If it's some other phase, then you don't know, right? You should worry about what this other phase is, and then you try to describe it and see what patterns you should get. Is that clear? Like, if the U1 quantum spin liquid phase is realized, then this is what you get. But if it's not, then you should redo the physics, right? But some people have claimed that this phase is actually realized in at least one real system this autumn. But of course, this is just one experiment. So,
so we should wait and see. So we should
say
that, like, if you can find a magnetic monopole, sorry.
That is better understood, because they also exist in the classical models, which have been successfully tested. So people have analyzed these kind of transition from monopole gas to a monopole liquid or something. So apparently this is better understood that these, at least the classical version of these monopoles actually exist. I can send you references. This is really fun. I can say one more thing about classical monopoles is that they're realized as emergent quasi-particles, right, of a strongly interacting system. They're not fundamental monopoles. So they don't have to obey this Dirac string condition, quantization and stuff like that. No, they're different in that sense. Yeah.
The bottom plot here looks almost periodic, but not quite. Is this an experimental or theoretical plot?
It's a theoretical plot. So it's cuts along the high symmetry directions in the Brillouin zone. So it doesn't look symmetric because this goes from like gamma to k, and I don't quite see because it's that. But my point is that you have a Brillouin zone in 3D, and then you make some high symmetry cut through it. So of course it won't look symmetric because you just sort of cut many different directions together in one graph. But yeah, it's a theoretical graph. Yeah.
Could you call these emergent photons a quasi-particle, or are they not?
Yeah, they are, because they are excitations. I mean, quasi-particles is a very generic term which applies to excitations that are like excitations of an interacting ground state. So they are not fundamental particles, but they are. It's a very generic term. Yes,
OPEC.
Can
you go to your conclusion slide? So the thing is that the last sentence, you say the symmetry of the system can be partially broken.
Yeah.
So to form the spin liquid. So it really means that in the spin ice, we have more symmetry than spin liquid?
Yes. Well, so that's when you apply an external electric field. So in doing that, you sort of specify one direction. But you apply the electric field in one given direction. And then the system responds by partially breaking the symmetry. So the point is that I haven't had time to talk about this. But you can partially break the symmetry by applying an electric field. But if you don't do anything, then both the quantum and classical models obey the same symmetry group, which is the symmetry group, or the lattice. Yeah.
Okay, so yeah, I would like to present to you guys this little paradox, one of those little cute relativity paradoxes called the submarine paradox, aka what would Archimedes have seen if instead of sitting in a bathtub, he was actually swimming relativistically when he decided to measure the weight of those coins. So basically, the idea of the paradox is very simple. For simplicity, let's take a submarine which has the same density as water. You put it there. And so it's going to be in equilibrium. And then you boost it in one direction, and you try to see what happens to it. So I will take two rest frames here. One of them is a fish. The other is a submarine. And the fish is at rest in respect to the sea. Does the submarine sink, or does it float? Now, you have arguments in both directions. It should sink, seeing from the fish's frame, because the submarine's density is going to increase when you boost it. The correct factor is gamma squared. And from that point of view, it should sink. But if you sink from the sub's frame, then it is the water around it that gets denser. And so from that point of view, it should float. And of course, the problem here, the paradox arises because we're treating gravity in, we're forgetting about gravity, right? We're just considering how densities change. We're not really doing any analysis of how the gravitational field changes. And that is indeed the key to solve this problem. So there are two papers where this question has been addressed. One of them was in 1989 by Suplee, and the other one was a more recent one by George Matsys in 2003. I'm going to present Suplee's argument and then Matsys's one, knowing that the GR argument is it's way more complicated, so I won't have time to go through all the steps. Spoiler, it sinks. Okay. So let's see how it goes. For Suplee's solution, he decides, instead of asking where does the force point to if it points up or down, instead he tried to ask, is there any moment where the submarine hits the bottom of the sea? which is a more practical way to calculate things without going into their true dynamics. So to set up our theoretical experiment here, I'll just call m0, v0, and rho 0 the proper mass, volume, and density of the submarine, recalling also that this is the same density as water. And I'll boost the submarine with a velocity v along the x-axis. We call the vertical axis z. And because we're dealing with gravity, in special relativity, we're going to use the principle of equivalence. So if you want to think of it clearly, you can pretend that instead of having a sea, you have this big box that you just put lots of water in it, and you put a submarine here, and you just put a rocket and make the sea go up. Okay? This is not very realistically, but it does suffice for our purposes. So let's see how everything goes when seeing from the Fisher's frame. The buoyancy force is basically going to be the one that we know. Because V0 is the proper volume of the submarine, evidently it's going to be compressed, so you get a gamma there. And when you calculate the vertical force, the general expression for the vertical force, you can do the derivative on both gamma and V, compare the scales, and realize that gamma equals constant is an excellent approximation. So just go with that. And by basically saying that one expression is equal to the other, you get that the velocity in the z direction should vary with g over gamma squared. Now, this is smaller than the full acceleration of the box, which is g. So from the box's point of view, you're going to the bottom, even though you're, of course, going up. And so you have a relative upwards acceleration of g minus g over gamma squared, knowing that the box is going up with acceleration g. And so eventually, you can match these two things and realize that there is a time where the submarine sinks. It hits the bottom. That's pretty straightforward. Now, what we'd like to do is see the same thing from the submarine's frame. And we have to ask, how does gravity change under boosts? This is not a very clear, well-posed question, but you can try to say that you have a particle in the bottom of the sea, which is accelerating up. And you can try to see how does it, for example, how does it velocity change under boosts? How does it acceleration change under boosts? And you see that if you, with a little manipulation of Lorentz transformations, you can get that, as seen from the submarine's frame, this thing goes up with g over gamma squared again. So that's how we're going to suppose that gravity changes under boosts. By doing that, you can do your standard kinematics again. And what you basically get is you get the same kinds of expressions, indeed, that the thing is going up with acceleration g. But now the problem is reversed. Now you have the force up on the particle is g. The force down is g over gamma squared. The particle is still going up. And the solution to this, namely that the particle seems to be going up with the same acceleration that it was going down in the previous problem, is that you can consider that the floor of the sea is curved now from the point of view of this guy, simply because if you take a point with a fixed x, which was going up with this expression for z bottom, when you go to the boosted frame, instead of depending only on time, it depends on both time and x. So you get this little expression here for a parabolic bottom of the sea. And if you equal these two expressions and solve the equations of motion, you get a time that this t sink prime, which is basically t sink, the expected time dilation, missing time contraction of the time as seen from the other frame. And so calculations agree, and there is no paradox here. OK, so all this is pretty cute, but it gets more fun if you put gr on it, right? So the idea is that for this analysis, we had used this, I would say, hypothesis of how gravity changes under boosts, which is not bad. But at the same time, you kind of try to, you know, to run away from the main question of how the dynamics of this thing works. And so we have to do a fully general relativistic approach. For that, you have to model basically the submarine and the fluid relativistically. You have to hope that your submarine is not going to break when you boost it, which is not trivial. And you also have to remember that when you compare forces up and down in GR, in relativity in general, you've got to be a little careful on where you're doing this comparison. So to construct the model, you basically take a Schwarzschild-like thing. We have the Earth here. You have this, the ocean here. And you say that your system is spherically symmetric and static. So you just say something like, this is radius. And what you do is that you focus on the surface. So you basically set up a coordinate system, let's say, here. So this would be x. This is going to be relabeled as z. So we're putting the surface of the ocean at z equals 0. And you just look very closely to this region. And as we saw in relativity course, what happens is that your Schwarzschild-like spacetime basically goes to a Rindler frame, Rindler frame being the frame of a uniformly accelerated observer. So the setup is we have these two Killing vectors, a time-like and a space-like one. The paper uses chi and zeta. I'm going to stay with that notation, but if you get confused, as I did, we'll just remind you later.
Sorry.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Yeah, it's not supposed to be that. Yeah, never mind. Never mind that part then. Just stay with the Rindler symmetry then. Okay? You got a point.
Is it not the cylindrical distance? Like the x squared plus y squared?
Sorry?
Can we just take x squared plus y squared equals r squared? Then we still have the correct. Then it still functions as a
case. You mean like ddx, ddy, and no?
Yeah, you just take r as the distance that is a cylinder.
Oh, if you're doing like a cylindrical coordinate. Yeah, sure. Sure. Also, this parameter alpha here, it's usually the acceleration of the Rindler observer. But for the time being, just take it as being a positive parameter. So you have we have these coordinates. Now, if you want to actually do the analysis, the paper starts with a very, very technical analysis on how this, basically the submarine goes from rest. It accelerates, and then it stays at a constant velocity. And they try to they do a model of how the stresses are involved, because you know if you try to boost something to the speed of light, something is going to break. So you have to basically do an analysis of the stress tensor and all, require that the submarine act as a rigid body for most of its motion. These are all very technical hypotheses. And it just in the end, it just turns out that if you have a submarine which is sufficiently thin, then that's enough for it to not break during acceleration. I'm not going to go into the details of how this acceleration part works. So once you have that, you have a system of particles. You have like a congruence, which has a four velocity u sub, which is parallel to this combination of the time-like Killing vector and that should be ddx. I'm sorry for that. The zeta one should be ddx so that it's parallel to the surface of the sphere. Anyway, and I think it's clear why it should be this combination. You have something, if it was just eta, sorry, just chi, which is the time-like one, then you're basically saying that your submarine is at rest. So you give it a little non-orthogonal component here. With velocity v, so that it has this particular coordinate velocity. And once that is done, you can also try to model water. And your water is basically a fluid at rest. So you give it the stress energy tensor of a perfect fluid, where the sub L means, of course, liquid, and where we choose this, the Lucas 4 velocity just to be a normalized normalized version of the time-like Killing vector. So that's basically it. It's still water and a submarine moving. Yes?
You just come back and say, why the exponential dependence on the depth?
On the, on this last part here?
Yeah.
Is this because of the choice that you did for the Rindler coordinates? You see that you have this exponential part there. So if you choose a thing to be normalized, it's basically going to have an exponential factor as well. OK. So now you can try to get the equations of motion for these things. And that's only useful because you're trying to get the dynamics. So you do the equation of motion for water, which is just the divergence of TAB is 0. You're going to get basically Euler's equation from fluid mechanics. And you can put in the special form here, which is useful for further analysis. And the only thing useful in here is that you're relating how pressure and pressure density and the redshift factor on the Rindler coordinates, how they all relate. Once that is done, now you want to try to find what is the real buoyancy force. To find the buoyancy force, you gotta you're basically gonna project the stress energy momentum tensor in the right places. So basically here what we do is that we, well, first of all, we set that notation for T for top and this little thing for bottom. And then you define this vector here, this vector n, which is simply a unit vector, which is perpendicular both to the forward velocity of the submarine as a whole and each of the surfaces. And then you take the projection of the energy momentum tensor along this thing. And you, if you calculate, it just turns out that this is going to be, you know, the pressure parts of the tensor. So that makes sense. And then you say, OK, force is just area times pressure. So you put here this last part here. You after calculating the pressures, which should have like an index top and down here, top and bottom, you calculate the force with the area. And you're going to find some kind of force. Once you have these forces, then you gotta basically, you want to take their difference and calculate the total force on the submarine. And that's a little annoying because, again, forces in different points don't have any meaning in GR. So you basically gotta try to, let's say, if you have some force here, you're basically gonna measure it in another point. You hope that this force is gonna be transmitted along some cables or something inside your submarine, which turns out to be equivalent to basically redshifting this force. And the redshift factor here is that eta function there, which I remind you is just the eta was the vector which was the sum of the time-like and the space-like Killing vectors. So it's basically the redshift factor of the observers in the submarine. And if I call the center of mass O, then simply this fraction here gives the redshift factor in the top and the bottom compared to the redshift seen by this observer. It's just like a normalization, if you will. And so if you take the buoyancy force to finally be the resultant force of these two, and you Taylor expand it, supposing that their submarine is pretty thin, you get that monster there, which you keep it that way. So we have one of the forces. We have the buoyancy force. We just need the gravitational force, and we're done. So now that we have the buoyancy force, I can calculate the gravitational force. And what happens is that, like, I don't know. Well, the acceleration that an observer, a static observer has, for example, like Schwarzschild spacetime, would be something like del mu of the ln of the basically the norm of the like the time-like Killing vector, for example. This is like this is the result that you can find. It's not obvious, but it's rather easy to derivate. And so this is the acceleration that it would feel, for example, a static observer. So now you take your observer to be like, it's not static anymore, but it's stationary. So you still have some kind of time-like Killing vector in this case, which is, you know, the sum of those two that is parallel to it. And then you can basically try to say, OK, the gravitational force is going to be minus what this thing would represent, which would be the forward acceleration of an observer in a general spacetime. In other words, I'm just trying to say that you can calculate on spacetimes which have symmetries, you can calculate gravitational force on an observer basically by saying gravitational force is minus the normal force that keeps the guy there. So in this case, I just have this, and I basically project it on the direction, on the vertical direction, and I find this expression here. And the expression itself is not the interesting part. The interesting part is, OK, I just put everything together. I sum gravity with buoyancy. I open up what they mean, and in the end of the day, I get something which is negative. So which means that even in this general relativistic setting, the submarine still sinks. In fact, you can try to do some simplifications now. This is like a precise answer. You can now do some kind of simplification to say, well, of course, water density is constant. I'm taking the submarine to be very close to the surface. And then you find this expression for the force, which is, of course, negative. And if you just compare it with your expected, well, force equals ma kind of equation of motion, you find this last equation here, the acceleration is minus gv squared, which is, I guess, the first equation in Suplee's paper, showing that in this limit, the GR solution and the special relativity solution are the same. So let me just conclude. The submarine sinks. It does so from a special relativistic point of view, because in the Fisher's frame, its density increases, and so does its weight. From the subs frame, although its density is going to be lower than that of the surrounding water, the bottom of the sea is also going up, and it's going up in such a in a curved way that allows for it to actually hit it in a finite time. We had to use this hypothesis of G boosting to G over gamma squared to do this in a special relativistic framework, which does not need to be done in GR. From a GR point of view, as you saw in this slide here, I get the force. The first expression there is in the Fisher's frame. The second expression is on the, I think the gamma factors are wrong, on the subs frame. And both of them are negative forces. And so from that point of view, the result is unambiguously that the submarine sinks. And that's it. Good then. Yeah?
So would this have any observable consequences in, say, accretion disks or proof of stars?
Well, you could have. I mean, you realize that this neglects every other physical aspect, like drag or, you know, or like waves or anything like that. So this is highly idealized. No, I don't think it would. Okay. All right.
Questions? Thank you, Mr.